Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to the National Gallery of Scotland. I apologise for the slightly late start, but we wanted as many of you as possible to breach the barricades and make your way in here. Welcome to our second sessional meeting of the year, and in particular to the fourth biennial faculty lecture. It is a huge thrill that our lecturer this evening is Sir Michael Ataya, one of the great mathematicians of his generation. And more about Sir Michael in just a moment. But I also have the pleasure and privilege tonight of presenting an honorary fellowship to Fred Rowley. It's a little over 12 months ago that I had the privilege of giving my presidential address, and at that time we were perhaps just past the worst of the financial crisis, but had no real idea at that time of how it was going to unfold. And I tried to remind the actuaries listening of the feedback that we have had from employers of and users of actuarial services, that the best kind of actuary, the one that is most valued, is one who is curious to find out how things work, financial things, energetic to find ways of making those financial things work better, and then lastly and equally importantly, influential enough to persuade their employers, their clients or the regulators to adopt those improvements. Curious, energetic and influential. And notwithstanding all the mayhem that was going on around us and some of the personal tragedies that was bringing, I also said then, and I believe it now, that this climate offers great opportunities for actuaries, because never has the world been more in need of the deep technical skills and the professional backbone for which our profession is renowned. Whether or not actuaries as a profession and actuaries as individuals can seize that opportunity will depend in part upon individual actuaries showing a boldness and an enterprise and a willingness to get outside their comfort zones into areas such as banking, where we don't have much of a profile. Partly it'll be down to those individual actuaries, but it's also incumbent on the profession to do as much as it can to clear the way for those enterprising actuaries, to serve our members by offering courses and training and development that allows them to seize the opportunities, by building public confidence, particularly with regulators, so that if people want to put actuaries into senior positions such as chief risk officer, then regulators will regard that as a good thing. And then lastly, in addition to serving our members, building public profile, also market the profession so that we're as well known in these new areas as we are in our traditional areas. The actuarial profession, as you know, is a very small profession, and even if we take the global actuarial profession, there are less than 40,000 fellows worldwide. And therefore, if we are to maximize our impact in areas such as risk management, why not try to maximize that impact by collaborating with other associations around the world so that the whole of the financial services industry around the world knows something of our capability and the skills that we can bring. And so it was with enormous delight that I, on behalf of the faculty and Nigel Masters on behalf of the Institute 10 days ago in Hyderabad in India, signed the treaty to initiate the Chartered Enterprise Risk Actuary, CERA. It has been, and there were 14 associations from 12 countries stretching from America in the west to Japan in the east through several European countries down to South Africa and Australia in the south, a truly global credential and something that no profession has ever seen before. No accountancy qualification spans the globe, no actuarial qualification, no legal qualification spans the globe. And here we are now, the Chartered Enterprise Risk Actuary, a qualification that not only serves the needs of financial institutions at this difficult time, but does so across the globe. Now, in Hyderabad, we all patted ourselves on the back and said, what a fabulous job we've done, what collaborative people we were, where we are, and what a lot of credit we should take from this groundbreaking initiative. But if I'm honest, it never would have got off the ground if it hadn't been for Fred Rowley, who some 3 years ago in Edinburgh had the vision to begin this quest, and who, through a combination of vision, charm, diplomacy, steel, and a lack of preparedness to take no for any question as answer to any question has dragged 14 associations, sometimes kicking and screaming to the point where we're now all congratulating ourselves for our collaboration. Fred, I know that you're very modest about this achievement, but without you, this qualification, which we hope will take the actuarial profession globally to new levels, would never have happened. And we're particularly grateful to you, because I know that in order to convene the various conference calls that were needed to get us to this point, you also made the sacrifice of doing it at midnight, Sydney time, in order to accommodate the Americans, the Europeans, and the Japanese, and all the others. And I'm grateful also and delighted that your wife Joan is here, because presumably Joan is very grateful that the treaty is signed, and she can get some sleep now instead of waiting for you to come to bed after all these phone calls. So Fred, it is with enormous pleasure that I, on behalf of Faculty Council and the members of the faculty, I can give you, with our thanks and blessing, an honorary fellowship to the Faculty of Actuaries. Take some pictures with me.
Well, thank you, Ronnie, for those very, very kind words. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here. It's a great honour to be receiving this honorary fellowship, and almost unimaginable. I think Ronnie will tell you in private that I was completely bowled over when he told me about this. And, to be honest, I remain bowled over to this minute. But nevertheless, I'm very honoured to be standing here in front of you. I'm particularly glad to be here in Edinburgh, a very fine and ancient city that I've liked for a long time. It's always a great pleasure to visit. And by coincidence, it was in fact in Edinburgh that Harry Panger first came over to me and said to me, well, wouldn't it be a good idea if we had a global qualification? And I can't tell the whole story, but the story moved from Edinburgh through Dublin, Quebec, and Limassol, and latterly through and Zurich as well, actually, and then Hyderabad, and here we are. I may be modest, but I think the associations are quite modest too. There's been a great team working on this, and it's been divided into two work streams between myself and Harry Panger, and between those groups, we have produced a syllabus and we've produced a treaty that the consequences of which we're not quite sure of yet. I wanted to thank Joan as well for her tolerance in those midnight phone calls. It's really, really nice to be here. And perhaps actually, Ronnie, we might never have had the treaty without Joan, because if she hadn't put up with all of those discomforts, then we wouldn't be here. But where the treaty takes us, where the new credential takes us forward is an interesting question, and I was forced to address it at the Faculty Council this afternoon. And it's interesting to see it in so many different dimensions. Firstly, it will be a very useful qualification for actuaries who are applying their trade every day. But it has strategic impact as well. It will take us, it will position us well to deal with the risk management function within Solvency II. It may have an impact on the way in which we educate young actuaries. It will certainly have an impact on the catchments, that is, on the quality and types of young people that we bring into the profession. And the existence of the treaty will be an incentive for the profession to globalize itself further. It is a model for how the International Actuarial Association can achieve the globalization that it sought for so long. So for me, this may be certainly the start of some more hard work, but it may also be the start of a lot of strategic progress. So watch this space, and we'll see where it takes us. For the past 2 or 3 years, those 14 associations and their presidents have honoured me by allowing me to manage them, as you say, kicking and screaming sometimes, to manage them forward to this very, very satisfying outcome. That was an honour in itself, but the receipt of this honorary fellowship is the crowning glory, and I'm very happy to be here to accept it, and I thank you for the compliment as the members of the faculty that you have paid to me. And I hope I'll find a way over the next few years to pay it back in some way. So thanks once again.
I should have gone through the whole of Fred's CV and mentioned the many positions of authority, the many research papers, the many other things he's done, including being president of the Institute of Australia, the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. But it would have it was such a long CV, we'd have never got anywhere. But Joan, as a tangible recognition of our thanks, and because Edinburgh is a kind of cold place and a lot colder than Sydney, we would like you to have this gift from the faculty in recognition of all your efforts to help with this. Now, if Fred's CV is long and glittering, Sir Michael's CV, reading it, leaves one extraordinarily humble. And it's no coincidence that not only is the hall tonight packed, but it is packed with a very distinguished, not only fellows of the faculty, but also a number of distinguished guests as well. Sir Michael's, the academic institutions whose corridors Sir Michael has graced, reads like a who's who of academia. Oxford, Cambridge, where he was Master of Trinity College, Princeton, Chancellor of the University of Leicester, Edinburgh University, where he's an honorary professor. He became a Fellow of the Royal Society at the age of 32, went on to win several of its most distinguished medals, including the Royal Medal and the Copley Medal. He then became President of the Royal Society in 1990 and later became President of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, retiring from that position just a couple of years ago. The list of medals, distinctions, and honours that Sir Michael has gained is enormous, but among them are the Field Medal given at the International Congress in Moscow, which many regard as the Nobel Prize of Mathematics, and I wouldn't want to single any of them out, but a great distinction. Sir Michael was knighted in 1983, and then in 1992 was given the Order of Merit, which is an honour, which is the personal gift of Her Majesty, and there are at any point in time there are only 24 people in the UK with Orders of Merit, which means it's even more rare than a Nobel Prize in the UK. So Sir Michael's list of distinctions are never ending, but clearly there is one distinction which is even rarer than an Order of Merit, and that is an honorary fellowship of the faculty, which there are fewer than 24 holders, even after today, and therefore, in our own small way, we believe to be the most elite qualification of all. Sir Michael, it has been an enormous thrill working with you in preparation for this, and I speak on behalf of the whole audience in being delighted that, although it says on your CV that you're now retired, it has been an extraordinarily difficult job finding a day when you were going to be in Edinburgh and not lecturing in far-flung corners of the world. And we're delighted that you're able to be with us tonight, and we very much look forward to what you have to say. Thank you. Sir Michael.
Back, I felt the least I could do in return, and Fred has to bear in mind that there are obligations to follow. also, it is a bit intimidating facing an audience with such a high IQ on this group of actuaries, very sharp people, the actuaries. So I'm worried that mistakes will be found in what I say. Already, somebody pointed out to me something I didn't know, so I'll have to be rather careful. My title is Lessons from the Scottish Enlightenment. And when I moved to Edinburgh 12 years ago, I immediately fell under the spell of this beautiful city with its medieval streets, beneath the castle, new town, alongside Prince Street Gardens, many hills dominated by Arthur's Seat and the Holyrood Park. But behind the architecture, there was the history and the culture, the great names of the past. And it was impossible not to sense that this was the home of the Scottish Enlightenment. that remarkable period in the 18th century, late 18th century, when this small country outshone its larger neighbours and contributed so generously to the intellectual history of the Western world. When in 2005 I was elected president of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, as you pointed out, which was founded in 1783 and embodied the spirit of the Scottish Enlightenment, I felt myself being absorbed by this great cultural heritage, occupying a post filled 200 years earlier by Sir Walter Scott. So when I was invited to give this lecture on a theme related to the Scottish Enlightenment, I was delighted. Of course, I'm not a professional historian, but sometimes there are advantages in not being a narrow specialist. And one of the characteristic features of the 18th century Edinburgh was the way it reached out in all directions. Lawyers talking to scientists, physicians talking to writers, all being philosophers in the broad sense. And as a mathematician, I think I would have felt at home in that milieu. Perhaps my vantage point is one that is appropriate to an audience of fellow actuaries. Different scholars have different views on the different defining dates of Edinburgh's great intellectual era. Some would narrow it down to just three or four decades around 1760. Others would be more generous, stretch it out in both directions. We mathematicians know enough about figures not to be too impressed by them. We know such choices are somewhat arbitrary, but I prefer to take a relaxed attitude on dates, and two natural boundary points are 1745, the date of the last Jacobite rebellion, and 1832, the year of Sir Walter Scott's death. But as I shall argue, the idea that Scotland had a brilliant cultural outburst that came from nowhere, disappeared abruptly, is totally misleading. So even these extended dates are just convenient stopping points. Now, since I'm not a historian, I thought I should carefully check my dates and others by facts, other facts, by consulting some standard works of reference. So I relied on the Encyclopedia Britannica, and the DNB, Dictionary of National Biography, though my son thinks I should just rely on Google. I was pleasantly surprised to find that the Encyclopedia Britannica proudly announces on its front page that it was first published in 1768 by a society of gentlemen in Scotland. As lawyers would say, I rest my case. I then checked the DNB, and lo and behold, it was founded in 1882 by one George Smith, who also turned out to be a Scot, though established in London. So having admitted my biased references, let me start by recalling the great names of the period. In the social sciences, Adam Smith and David Hume remain as famous now as in their day. Though we should remember that while Smith is viewed as the father of economics, he saw himself also as a philosopher. Similarly, David Hume, a great philosopher, was a highly regarded historian. All this was done in his spare time, since he had to earn his living as a diplomat. In the natural sciences, Joseph Black, the chemist, discovered CO2, much in the news these days, and James Hutton told us how old the Earth was. In literature, Walter Scott had to compete in fame with Robbie Burns. Some may question whether the peasant poet was an Enlightenment figure. He was certainly not really at home in Edinburgh society, but I'll come back to that later. In the arts, there was the Adam family of architects, while portrait painting could boast Alan Ramsay and Henry Raeburn. Now, I confess that my enthusiasm for 18th century Edinburgh has sometimes become excessive. I was telling a German friend of mine that during this period, Edinburgh was the intellectual and cultural centre of Europe. After listening to my claims, he quietly asked, "What about music?" And I was chastened to realize that Mozart was a contemporary of Adam Smith. And even I could not argue the musical merits of the bagpipes in that competition. Although I've been told this evening that there were some distinguished composers in Scotland at that time, so when I publish this version, there will be some additional corrections. In addition to the internationally famous names I mentioned, there were many more, of slightly lesser note, who played an important part locally. As an illustration of the lack of specialization among Edinburgh intellectuals, let me just briefly mention two judges who, besides being eminent in their profession, also had much wider interests and were at the centre of society. One was Henry Home, who became Lord Kames and wrote extensively on philosophy. And let me quote this passage about his early life, which clearly shows both his energy and the wide scope of his learning. He thereupon set to work to repair the defects of his early education. Having applied himself to the study of mathematics, natural philosophy, logic, ethics, metaphysics, as well as law, he was called to the Scottish Bar in May 19, 1724. So he was clearly a man of considerable learning, as you might see. The other judge, James Burnett, later Lord Monboddo, was even more energetic in his spare time, writing first 6-volume work on the origin and progress of language, and then another 6-volume work on ancient metaphysics. He was also an eccentric, with a great admiration for the ancient Greeks. Since they had not used carriages, he also declined such luxury, and would regularly make the long journey from Edinburgh to London on horseback. In pre-Darwinian days, he was brave enough to consider man as related to the orangutan. And the Encyclopedia Britannica of the 1870s, notice the date, had this to say about him. His views about the origin of society and language, and the faculties by which man is distinguished from the brutes, afforded endless matter for jest by the wags of his day. You know what it means? They had pictures of orangutans dressed as judges on the bench, or pictures of judges swinging from trees. But readers of this generation, that the 1870s, shortly after Darwin's book was published, are more likely to be surprised by the scientific character of his method and the acuteness of his conclusion than amused by his eccentricities. So yeah, his ideas were actually preceded those of Darwin in many interesting ways. He was a remarkable character. And I also like the comment made in the DNB that during the temporary cessation of business owing to the rebellion of 1745, Burnett paid a visit to London, where he made the acquaintances of many of the literary characters of the day. He wasn't somebody to be put off by a minor rebellion. He carried on as usual. I myself find it fascinating to enter the Edinburgh Society of the time by reading about these interesting characters and their social interactions, the dinners they shared in their taverns and clubs, where conversation covered the whole range of intellectual topics. They all had a remarkable stamina for both claret and philosophy, as recounted by James Boswell, and they often walked many miles to their homes after these extended entertainments. But my purpose tonight is not to regale you with stories of the nightlife of Edinburgh 2 centuries ago, but to reflect on how it came about that this small, cold, northern outpost of civilization became such a prominent centre of intellectual life. What were its origins? Why did it flourish? And what was its long-term influence? What can we learn from its history that has lessons for our present and future? Edinburgh has frequently been called the Athens of the North. And is it then like modern Greece, just a small country glorying in its ancient history, or is the Enlightenment still at the core of our life, driving us forward? Well, I'll approach these questions in 3 different contexts, which I will label the following way: as historical, what came before, what followed, and it's here we'll see that precise dates blur and are replaced by a vague continuum. Be geographical, the relation with England, the continent, America, and the British Empire. And finally, social, the integrated nature of Edinburgh society that I've referred to with no disciplinary barriers. But before going down this route, I will spend some time on the fundamental topic of education, which then as now underpins all aspects of society. Now, although there's no simple explanation for the remarkable developments of 18th century Scotland, one fact is undoubtedly crucial. Scotland had the most literate general population of any country in Europe and probably the world. For this, we have to thank John Knox and the Reformation, which emphasized the direct access of each individual to God through the Bible. The Presbyterian Church established primary schools so that children could learn to read. And universal primary education, therefore, came to Scotland several centuries before it was adopted in England. And it's difficult to overemphasize the importance of such widespread education. For example, it explains how Robert Burns, a farmer's son, received the education that nourished his poetic genius, and in this sense, he belongs to the Divine Enlightenment. However, the Scottish educational advantage was not restricted to primary schools. Far from it. I remind you that Scotland had four universities established by the 16th century. St. Andrews first, Edinburgh the last, and while England, with its much larger population, had until the 19th century only Oxford and Cambridge. I think this alone explains how Scotland produced so many graduates who made their mark on the outside world. You could say that an educated class was, for hundreds of years, Scotland's main export. And herein lies the first lesson, still highly relevant to our present time. Education, all the way from primary school to postgraduate work, is the main hope of a small country like Scotland. But in the 21st century, other countries are rapidly catching up, and it will be no easy task for Scotland to maintain its traditional advantage. But two things are in its favour: the high quality of its education and the long timescale of educational change. The education of a child can last these days for 20 years. Teachers are in post for over 40 years. Educational institutions are like great ocean liners, which change course very slowly. Beyond that, general culture of a society has deep roots and outlives individual generations. So Scotland's cultural heritage, in its education in the broadest sense, still has momentum, which, if properly harnessed, can keep it going a while long. I will return to this theme later in my lecture. Now, while the four Scottish universities all made their contribution, by the 18th century, Edinburgh was the largest and most important, and it played a central role in the Enlightenment. Two related things were in its favour. First, Edinburgh, as the capital, was by far the largest and wealthiest city in Scotland. Second, Edinburgh University was not an ecclesiastical foundation beholden to the bishop. The City Council of Edinburgh had established the university, and there were few religious barriers for admission. Unlike Oxford and Cambridge, which remained firmly under the Anglican Church until the 19th century, Edinburgh presented the world as a free market. This, at least, was the position by the 18th century. I've passed rapidly over the turbulent times preceding that. The Reformation, which led to universal primary education, also started with an extremist uniformity whose touches the university did not fully escape until the early 18th century. But by this time, the university was thoroughly reorganized by several enlightened principles. Professors in specialist fields were appointed to lecture, and students chose those they wanted to attend with few regulations. It was really a free market. However, they had to pay a fee for each course of lectures, and this went to the professor giving the course. Professorial stipends were low, and the student fees provided the main income of the professors. Now, you may be interested, but not surprised, to know that Adam Smith agreed with Principal Robertson that it would be undesirable to increase the salaries of the professors, move which might render them less attentive to the instruction of their students, or independent of the involvement arising from a diligent performance of their duties. Interesting remarks for our times. This policy of incentives worked well, as Smith predicted. The professors, who were all distinguished scholars, carefully selected by the principal, gave brilliant lectures, attracting students in great numbers from far and wide. The university grew in size and reputation. By contrast, Oxford and Cambridge were at their lowest point, illustrated by the story that the Regius Professor of History at Oxford had not given a single lecture in 150 years. Now, as actuaries, you will have worked out this did not refer to just one man, but to the post. A central role in the university was played by medicine. Not only did it provide professional training for future physicians, but in those less specialized times, it had also close links with the other sciences, such as chemistry. Professors frequently switched their chairs towards the more popular and lucrative ones, and medical students often went on to other scientific careers. It's indeed notable how many famous scientists, including Charles Darwin, and that polymath Thomas Young, who demonstrated the wave nature of light and also helped Champollion to decipher the Rosetta Stone, came to science via medicine. Now, let me move a little bit from education to historical context, gradually. as you heard in an earlier phase of my life, and I was president of the Royal Society, and occupied Newton's chair there, the master of Trinity College, where Newton was Cambridge base, I naturally was an enthusiast for 17th century England. Fortunately, that was a good period in England. Same questions concerning the origins and future of this intellectual flowering arise a century before those we are examining in Scotland. In astronomy, when Newton made his name, his great predecessor was Galileo, who, conveniently for historians, died in 1642, the year of Newton's birth, thus passing on the scientific torch from Italy to England. But there was more than individual genius involved here. Famously, Galileo had to face a hostile Catholic Church. Henry VIII had removed England from the orbit of the Pope. So science in England could flourish without worrying too much about the Church. But there is another question which has always intrigued me. English science was blossoming exactly at the time of the Civil War, a long and bloody contest which one might think would be inimical to intellectual progress. On the contrary, science flourished, and the Royal Society was formally established under the royal auspices at the Restoration. How does one explain this paradox? Does a civil upheaval help the progress of ideas? Perhaps it does so by undermining authority. Significantly, the Royal Society motto is Nullius in Verba, which is usually interpreted as do not trust the word of authority, or more simply, do not believe all you're told. Certainly, religious diversity, which lay behind the Civil War, reduced the heavy hand of religious conformity. It's also true that the leading scientists survived the war, unlike the situation in France a century later, where Lavoisier was sent to the guillotine. English scientists were more fortunate and politically more skillful. Some, like John Wallis, a predecessor of mine as the civilian professor of geometry at Oxford, were too valuable to royalists and Cromwell alike as experts on secret codes, rather like the German rocket scientists after 1945. But if the Civil War did indeed assist the flowering of English science, what happened after the death of Newton? Why did it decline? There are several reasons suggesting so. First, the dominance of Newton, the controversy with Leibniz, cut English mathematical science off from the great progress that took place in France and Germany. Second, Oxford and Cambridge reached their lowest point in the 18th century, contributed little to intellectual life. Finally, the Royal Society, the focal point of English science, fell under the sway of Joseph Banks, the great botanist who sailed to Australia with Captain Cook, and after whom the Banks have planted the name. Now, that portrait of Banks that you see there gives you an indication of his strength of character. He dominated the Royal Society, and in fact, he still dominates it. That portrait hangs in the council chamber of the Royal Society, keeps all current council members under control. Unfortunately, Banks presided over the Royal Society for 42 years, much too long a period, I think we'd all agree. As a botanist, he was not sympathetic to the more mathematical sciences which were emerging, which were held back until Banks' death in 1820. So it's not until the 19th and 20th centuries that English science recovered its leading position. Meanwhile, the field was left open for Scotland. The Act of Union of 1707 transformed the economic situation and opened up the opportunities offered by the expanding British Empire. The move of Parliament to Westminster diverted able young men from the pursuit of politics to the professions of law, medicine, and education, preventing a potential brain drain. By the time the railways had appeared, bringing London much closer to Edinburgh, and without those long horseback rides on one motto, Edinburgh had an established, thriving cultural life which could compete with London. But here again we can see a lesson for the present. If Scotland is to maintain its high intellectual standard, it will have to work to prevent a brain drain of its talent, not only to England, but to the rest of the world. Exporting ideas and people is an important role for Scotland in an increasingly interconnected world. But this must not become a flood. Conditions here should remain attractive for those who want to stay, as well as those from other countries who wish to settle here. Word about the defining dates of the Scottish Enlightenment. The argument for 1745 is that with the Jacobite threat finally removed, the Scots were no longer viewed with the same suspicion as potential subversives. They enjoy the freedom and prosperity that encouraged art and science and that blossomed in the second half of the century. While there's some truth in these views, it's also true you cannot jumpstart social change. Education has a long gestation period, and the universities had been advancing for some decades before 1745, as I've tried to indicate. Without such an educational foundation, the political and economic opportunities would not have had the same spectacular consequences. Perhaps here I can come back to our own times, where the importance of education is universally recognized but grossly misunderstood. When I was president of the Royal Society in London, I had fairly frequent contact with the ministers of education. In my 5-year presidency, I think I had to deal with no less than 3 ministers. There they are. You might recognize some. At least one is trying to re-emerge from obscurity. A little older. The post was usually regarded as a stepping stone to higher office. Each incoming minister was in a hurry to make his or her name and move on. Constant reform, change, assessment was the order of the day, totally ignoring the long-term nature of education. Scotland always had its own educational system, and now with devolution has its own minister. It may avoid the worst of the Westminster musical chairs, but as long as education remains a political football, it will continue with a 5-year horizon. That's the unit of political time. If Scotland is to have the education it needs to maintain its place in the world, this has to be put at arm's length from party politics, given the breathing space it requires. Having just argued that the early date of 1745 does not by itself herald the dawn of enlightenment, let me now examine the other endpoint, the date of 1832, with the death of Walter Scott. While it is true that by this time England was beginning to recover its earlier standing, it's a serious mistake believe that Scottish intellectual progress came to an abrupt halt with the death of Scott. In the sciences, his greatest days were just beginning. Lord Kelvin, James Clerk Maxwell, dominating the field of physics. While Kelvin, who was partly an engineer with his role in the transatlantic cable, lived to a ripe old age and was given a peerage by Queen Victoria, Maxwell was the greater scientist whose fame grew after his early death. Now widely regarded as the greatest physicist between Newton and Einstein and the greatest scientist produced by Scotland. And nor should the era of Kelvin and Maxwell be considered as a new period unrelated to the Enlightenment. The universities that trained them were those which grew to maturity in the previous century. And there are even personal links. Maxwell's father was a friend of Scott and sought his advice on what school his son should attend. Ironically, Scott was a supporter of the new Edinburgh Academy, which had been set up by those like himself who thought that the older high school was neglecting the classics in favour of trendy subjects like the sciences. So Maxwell was sent to the academy, which was firmly devoted to the classics, but fortunately genius surmounts such minor obstacles. As you will have gathered, I am an enthusiastic devotee of Clerk Maxwell, and it was a matter of great satisfaction to me that I persuaded the Royal Society of Edinburgh to commission a statue of Maxwell, which now graces a prominent site on George Street, just opposite Standard Life, where it is. I hope you've seen it. If you hadn't, run around straight away after dinner. It stands on George Street, just opposite the Standard Life building, which is no doubt familiar to actuaries. By the way, this site was actually empty, but had previously been occupied by much bigger statues of Gladstone, the Prime Minister. But that was rude at the time to make way for cars. So far, Maxwell has survived the trams. Maxwell's work on electromagnetism not only provided the scientific foundations for the technological marvels that now surround us, but it also underpins all subsequent physical theory. In this sense, the Scottish Enlightenment never ended. It continues to influence to the present time. While Kelvin lived on into the 20th century, even Maxwell did not so far back in time. For example, my maternal grandfather was a Scot, born around 1860, at a time when Maxwell was still a young man. Now, as a great scholar has said, history is about chaps and geography is about maps. So let me now move on to examine the geographical context of the Scottish Enlightenment. I've already alluded to the Newtonian era of English science. And while these new ideas landed on stony ground in France and elsewhere on the continent, they were rapidly adopted in Scotland. Two notable Scottish mathematicians who were Newtonian disciples were David Gregory and Colin Maclaurin. The latter, after whom your own building is named, is well known to actuaries because of his pioneering work on widows' pensions. Gregory was one of a large and prominent Scottish family, and he eventually went to Oxford and became civilian professor of geometry. Looking up all the Gregories of the DNB, I found that one reason why they were so prominent. Even by the standards of the time, they were remarkably prolific. David's father had 32 children by only two wives. So it's not surprising that this included a few with mathematical talents. In fact, one can trace a continuous development of Scottish mathematicians from Napier through Gregory and Maclaurin, followed by names like Playfair in the 18th century, to Clerk Maxwell in the 19th. There are no sharp discontinuities, and of course, mathematics played a central role during the Enlightenment. At a time when travel by sea was easier and faster than by land, Scotland had firm direct links with countries like France and the Netherlands. The French connection was, of course, a key part of Scottish history, but the Netherlands had a greater influence on universities. Leiden had the famous medical school, where all aspiring students went. The early professors in Edinburgh would have learnt their medicine at the feet of the great Boerhaave. But in due course, Edinburgh took over this role from Leiden. Russia, from the time of Peter the Great, was part of the scientific community of Europe, its own academy in St. Petersburg. Remarkably, its first director from 1783, in the year Royal Society of Edinburgh was founded, the director was a woman, the Princess Blashkova. It's true she owed her appointment to her close friendship with Catherine the Great, whom she helped in a minor coup, but she was a talented woman and a successful director. We counted Benjamin Franklin among her correspondents and became the first woman member of the American Philosophical Society. It's an indication of the status of Edinburgh that Princess Blashkova spent 3 years here while her son studied at university. In fact, Blashkova had decided Edinburgh University was the best place to send her only son and arranged with Principal Robertson for a specifically tailored course. Fortunately, the son survived this close maternal supervision, though the relationship with his mother did not. While in Edinburgh, Blashkova participated fully in the social and intellectual life of the capital, bridging the wide gap between the two northern outposts of Europe. These links with Europe show that Scotland was an integral part of the old world, but it was the new world where Scotland's future influence lay. As you know, many Scots of all classes emigrated to North America, and they were particularly prominent in religious and educational circles. John Witherspoon, that's Benjamin Franklin and Mrs. Dashkova, but I'm moving on now. John Witherspoon, minister from Paisley, was a notable example. He became president of what became Princeton University and one of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence. In fact, the only clergyman to be such a signatory. Incidentally, a statue of Witherspoon shown there by Alexander Stoddart, who was the sculptor who made the statue of Maxwell here, stands both in Paisley and on the Princeton University campus. Witherspoon was only one of many Scots who built up the fledgling universities of America. This explains why, with their four-year courses, they are modelled on the Scottish system and not on Oxford and Cambridge. This is particularly evident in medicine, where medical faculties in the United States were founded in the main by Edinburgh graduates. An important role in the transmission of culture across the Atlantic was in fact played by Benjamin Franklin, who twice visited Edinburgh for extended stays at the height of the Enlightenment. Franklin was a great friend and admirer of David Hume. They share the same sceptical outlook. They kept up a regular correspondence, which you can examine personally, as I did, in the National Library of Scotland. And I'm glad to see that Michael Anderson, National Library, is here to hear me thank them for this. I particularly liked the letter Franklin wrote to another friend, October 27, 1771, through storms and floods, things don't change. I arrived here on Saturday night, late, and was lodged miserably at an inn. But that excellent Christian David Hume, agreeable to the precepts of the gospel, has received the stranger, and I now live in his house in the new town most happily. I purpose staying about a fortnight and shall be glad to hear from you. Stephen, yours most affectionately, B. Franklin. Well, as you know, that must have been written with a bit of tongue-in-cheek, a reference to good Christian David Hume. Franklin was lionized in Scotland, picked up an honorary degree at St. Andrews, after which he became Dr. Franklin, and thoroughly enjoyed the stimulating nature of Edinburgh society, made up in equal measure of good food, good wine, and good conversation. He was also impressed by Edinburgh University and its great medical school, so much so that he played a large part in encouraging his young contemporaries to undertake the rough crossing of the North Atlantic to pursue their medical education. He advised and assisted many young men in his way, helping some from his own pocket. His efforts were so successful that around 10% of the medical students in Edinburgh were American. They returned to found the main medical schools of Philadelphia, New York, and elsewhere. When I was in Philadelphia a few years back to celebrate Franklin's tercentenary, I was taken aback to find these medical pioneers identified as English, and hastened to correct my hosts. Incidentally, when I was going through immigration at Newark Airport, I was asked the purpose of my visit. I rather facetiously said I was going to a birthday party. When the inquisitive official asked whose birthday, I replied Benjamin Franklin. The well-informed and straight-faced reply was, I thought he was dead. Franklin was, of course, famous for his work on lightning and lightning conductors. One of his letters to Hume, published by the Royal Society of Edinburgh, was on this subject. However, there was some controversy on the best shape of lightning conductors. Should they be pointed, as advocated by Franklin, or round? King George III set up a committee of the Royal Society of London to investigate this question. This was chaired by a Scot, Sir John Pringle, president of the Royal Society at the time. In due course, Pringle reported back in favour of Franklin's view. The king was not amused. Franklin was a rebel, so he must be wrong. Pringle was sacked by the king, but he had the last word. Your Majesty can alter the laws of the land, but cannot alter the laws of nature. I think that's a magnificent phrase on which to go out when you're being sacked. In fact, almost worth being sacked for this, you know what I'm saying. As we move on into the 19th century, we find Scots taking full advantage of the growth of the British Empire, building railways in exotic places, leaving their mark wherever they went. I came across an amusing example of this some years ago when I was taken to a hill station high in the mountains south of Mumbai at a place called Mahabaleshwar, a favourite retreat for the British in the hot season. I was shown the sights, including a magnificent lookout point with a spectacular view that gloried in the name of Arthur's Seat. The legendary King Arthur was clearly transported across space and time by some Scottish officer. I found it a nice thought that one might climb our local Arthur's Seat to escape the oppressive heat of an Edinburgh summer. But it was not only the empire beyond the seas that attracted the Scots. Some went south to England. Many, like James Watt, played a notable part in the Industrial Revolution. But there is another group who made an enormous contribution and who are much less known. These are the civil servants who were responsible for the vast improvement in public health in 19th century England, with a notable reduction in mortality, which I'm sure your actuarial tables record. The leaders were mainly Scots and again products of the Edinburgh Medical School. These few remarks show the worldwide influence of the Scots. From the 18th century onwards, all children or grandchildren of the Enlightenment. This demonstrates convincingly there were no boundaries in space or time to the benefits flowing from the Scottish Enlightenment. The past leads into the present and prepares us for the future. Let's now move on to what I have labelled the social context, the way the different strands of life and ideas are woven together. One of the most remarkable features of 18th century Edinburgh was how compact it was. Until the development of the new town, the city was centred on the medieval streets adjoining the Royal Mile, from the castle to Holyrood Palace. Like Manhattan, 2 centuries later, there's no way to expand except up, which led to the buildings we can still see, with innumerable stories frequently facing different ground levels back and front. people literally lived on top of one another with notoriously unsanitary conditions. Uncomfortable and unhealthy it must have been, but it also generated a closely knit society which produced great men and great ideas. It was said with pride, and only modest exaggeration, that you could stand at the Murcat Cross and in half an hour shake 50 men of genius by the hand. The outcome was that Edinburgh had a vibrant and diverse intellectual society that was all-inclusive. A prominent role was played by the lawyers, both advocates and judges, whose learning, as I indicated earlier, was not confined to the law. Then there was the medical profession, centered around the prominent medical school of the university. Other branches of the university also flourished, with mathematicians, scientists, historians, and philosophers. Boundaries were fluid, professors often exchanged chairs. They would sometimes acquire their specialist knowledge after appointment rather than before. The whole atmosphere encouraged the free exchange of ideas, and there was little to inhibit it. The days of rigid orthodoxy were over. Nothing demonstrates this better than the case of David Hume. Although his religious scepticism was widely known, he was an admired and central figure of Edinburgh society. It's true that he never got a university chair, but on several occasions he was a serious candidate. This was a major step forward when one considers that the last witch in Scotland was burned at the stake during his lifetime. This was the multifaceted society that attracted Benjamin Franklin and gave birth to the Royal Society of Edinburgh, for which Franklin was the first foreign member. Attending his meetings, I feel a close kinship with 18th century Edinburgh, and although the world has changed enormously in those 200 years, the RSE attempts to preserve the unity of knowledge and culture, maintaining the bridge from the sciences to the humanities and social sciences. We still have judges who enjoy the company of scientists and mathematicians and even actuaries. Is the attempt to maintain a unified intellectual front a hopeless task, one that increasing specialization makes impossible? Or is there still a role for the unity of knowledge? I would argue strongly that even as knowledge deepens within each field, we have to maintain the horizontal crosslinks. In science, the days of narrowly defined departments of physics, chemistry, biology have long since gone, been replaced by interdisciplinary subjects like biochemistry or molecular biology, titles which in their turn will give way to newer ones. Moreover, the impact of science and technology on modern society means we have to face problems which are not confined to any one area. Climate change and energy are just two of the most topical, while medical advances raise ethical as well as actuarial problems of increasing importance. More than ever, we need the collective wisdom and experience that is spread across society. We may not all be able to meet at the Murcat Cross, but we should look back to the Enlightenment for inspiration, and nor should we ignore the stimulus that good food can provide for intellectual conversation. Look forward to tonight's dinner. The galaxy of talent flourished, so these are my final thoughts, the galaxy of talent that flourished in 18th century Edinburgh always raises the question, was it simply a coincidental emergence of individual genius or the result of historical forces? In other contexts, this has been debated at length. Was Napoleon a military genius who changed the face of Europe, or was he simply the inevitable product of the French Revolution? Tolstoy, being a Russian, played down the individual role of Napoleon, opted strongly for the latter view. If you're a gardener, it's hard to deny that seeds would only germinate successfully in the right soil and weather conditions. So genius needs the proper environment in order to develop its full potential. What would Isaac Newton have achieved if he had been born in the Stone Age? Well, perhaps someone like him who first invented the wheel. I rather like the Punch cartoon published during a controversy by university research, which showed two Stone Age men discussing another who was passing by with the comment, "I know he discovered a fire. What has he done since?" A poignant and poetic reflection on this theme is contained in the famous lines of Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard: "Some mute inglorious Milton here may rest, some Cromwell guiltless of his country's blood." I'll overlook the fact that it's rather unfair on Cromwell. It's tempting for Scots to believe it was Scottish genius that changed the 18th century, something peculiar to the Scottish people. But this is dangerous ground, one small step to Hitler's view of Aryan superiority. But if genius does not lie in the Scottish DNA, then the Scottish Enlightenment seems just a random accident of history. In particular, it will not happen again. The 5 million present-day Scots will be no match for the billions of Indians and Chinese with whom we now have to compete. This is a depressing thought, so let me try and cheer you up. As I've tried to indicate, Scottish Enlightenment was not just a flash in the pan of a few decades. It had deep roots, a long life, and a continuing future. We today are its inheritance. Those 300 years of cultural evolution, rather than our DNA, defines present-day Scotland. And this continues to give us an advantage. And no country can shake off its past and transform itself in a fundamental way in one generation. Thank you.
Sir Michael. Sir Michael has offered to take comments and questions for a few minutes on the basis of his provocation to you to be the new Enlightenment. So please, there are some microphones. So if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, please do stick up your hand and say who you are, because this lecture tonight is being put on an MP3 and will be available on the profession's website for others to all over the world to hear. We have a question for Sir Michael. Yes, Cairns.
Cairns Mason. I wonder, Sir Michael, whether you would do us the favour of taking a couple of minutes to extend it from the Edinburgh Enlightenment back to the Scottish Enlightenment. particularly, the Aberdeen School of Philosophers probably gets forgotten more even than Glasgow. Glasgow can stand up for itself. We've got Thomas Reid, Gerard, Beattie, all operating out of Aberdeen and contributing their own unique part of the 18th century. Do you feel you can comment on that for us, please?
Well, I only comment to agree. I mean, this lecture takes place in Edinburgh, a city that I know well and so on. And Edinburgh was certainly the capital and played the biggest role. Obviously, other parts of Scotland also played a significant role. And I mean, not everybody born and bred in Edinburgh. Adam Smith came famously from Concordia. And so people, I mentioned Don Witherspoon will work in Paisley. So the other parts of Scotland, and I mentioned all the universities, all play their role. And if I had time and knowledge, I would elaborate on all their contributions. It was a small country, and obviously people moved around, and there was a sort of connection between every different institutions, different people. So the fact that I only talked about Edinburgh was just my own ignorance and the shortage of time and the fact that we're here in Edinburgh. I apologize to Aberdeen. Although I have to say that Aberdeen has a black mark on its reputation as the only university that sacked James Clerk Maxwell.
Talks about the Greenock Enlightenment, my hometown, but I'm sure. Well, James Watt, sorry, I've done my hometown a disservice. Who else would like to make a comment or ask a question? David. Oh, sorry, Joe, and then you go first, and then David.
Is it working?
Yes.
I've often thought it interesting that the Scottish Enlightenment really got going some decades after our Parliament had moved to London. And there did seem to be a sort of inverse correlation there, that in the sense that the further you are from the Parliament, the more reduction in intellectual. And I'm wondering if there's a lesson here for our own time, and indeed for the future. Perhaps if we moved this all to Brussels, we might be able to get on with something.
Well, I did, of course, allude to that when I said the move of the Parliament to Westminster meant that politics was no longer immediately available attraction for talent, and talent was therefore diverted into more productive areas. In that sense, I don't agree with you. So, whether the politicians had the same attraction anymore, I'm not sure. But those researchers would have wanted power, gravitated into Parliament.
Okay.
comments?
And you can make criticisms too. I mean, don't worry, tell me I'm wrong on this or that. And I can modify the text when it's published. Hand up there.
Can I comment on? Beg your pardon, David Wilkegan. Can I comment on another aspect? You didn't very much mention the ministers as people involved, but one of the early people who comes to the actuary, Wallace, was a minister and was involved with setting up the Church of Scotland pension scheme. And the namesake of mine, who rather curiously, the Reverend David Wilkie, wrote a book on compound interest and annuities and constructed life tables. He was also the father of the painter of yet again the same name. So naturally, I have an interest in these people, though they're no relation whatever.
Well, I did refer, of course, to John Witherspoon, who played this big role. And of course, at the time, ministers were everywhere and very prominent in all respects. No novelty to point out the ministers were involved in every activity. But I could have identified more. Yes, right. Not neither a historian nor an economist. Well, Scotland had, well, of course, the people will tell you that there were a lot of sugar plantations out in the West Indies which kept Scotland going. The wealth came through Glasgow to Scotland was very substantial on the backs of slaves. So that's a slightly embarrassing fact, but that's certainly one of the sources. I mean, put it more generally, the British Empire provided opportunities, economic opportunities, which following Adam Smith's precepts, were fully taken up, and that's certainly later on the source of Scotland's wealth. That may not have applied very early on, and but whether you needed great wealth to have a few good lectures at university, I'm not sure. And that pays dividend. These chaps go away, and you know, big contributions. It's a very good investment. I think actuaries are very, very sound on investment.
A few people in Edinburgh. Bank of Scotland wondered where all the money came from as well, or at least where it's all gone. Anyway, nothing much has changed. One last, Brendan.
Brendan McBride. So, Michael, towards the end, you asked, is there a role for the unity of knowledge? And leaving aside the possibility of that unity being achieved by the Large Hadron Collider, having us all disappear simultaneously into a black hole, given the diversity of the types of knowledge, I didn't quite see how you felt it still could be a role for that unity. Could you say a bit more about that?
Well, I mean, increase in specialization and depth of knowledge means, of course, that people, no individual can cover the same scope as before. But nevertheless, it is possible at a higher level to exchange ideas across borders between different fields, particularly when they are interconnected at a social level, a more economic level. So all these questions about global warming and so on involves experts of all possible types, including economists and politicians, and they would get together in various fora and exchange ideas about how to act. It certainly is possible at the right level. You can't exchange ideas of technical detailed knowledge, but you can in terms of impact of the ideas and the connections between different fields. And it's a higher level of abstraction. It's not just talking in the marketplace. It's talking about the impact of ideas on society as a whole. And it's absolutely vital that we don't go into our separate silos, close the doors and say, sorry, I can't help you because you're but not my field. That would be the disaster.
One last question before we wind up. One more. Yes, David.
Thanks. My name is David Hare. Sir Michael, if the Scottish Enlightenment had happened at a time where there were World Wide Web chat rooms and the easy access of knowledge and discussion worldwide, who do you think who would you have liked to see in other parts of the world at the time taking part in the Enlightenment discussions in the chat rooms, and what do you think might have been the result?
Well, of course, Benjamin Franklin and David Hume were chatting. They wrote letters, which took longer, of course. But, I mean, people did communicate, just slower. And perhaps because of that, it was in greater depths. You didn't just chat, you thought. But it's true that, I mean, and think of the poor historians of the future. I mean, now people can look back and see what David Hume and Benjamin Franklin wrote to each other in the beautiful color plate writing. You could read it absolutely. Now, what have you got? Lots of chitter-chatter on the web, and hard to find. And when you do find it, it just has a little stupid comment. So the historian of the future will have no idea what really went on behind the scenes, you know, in the faculty of actuaries or the RAC or
We'll draw to a close. When faculty council had the initial idea of inviting Sir Michael to speak and had the initial idea that Lessons from the Enlightenment might be a suitable title, one which Sir Michael seized on with great enthusiasm. We were in the dark days of the financial crisis, and in a way we were looking to you, Sir Michael, to give us some insight and some inspiration as to how we might get out of these dark financial times when, you know, the joke going around the comedians at the dinner was, how do you buy a small Scottish bank? You buy a big one. You wait. That we were looking to you for insight and inspiration as to how we in our small profession might play a part in getting perhaps not the glittering enlightenment that you've shown us here tonight, but at least some small chink of light at the end of what seemed at that time to be a very dark tunnel. And you have, Sir Michael, exceeded all our expectations, which were based on your reputation already high. You've shown yourself not only to be a great mathematician, but an accomplished historian with a sideline in paying conditions for professors, which I'm sure will have will have gone down very well with the people in the front three rows here, many of whom fit that bill. And you've done so in a charming and engaging way, one that actually puts things in context, so that although a number of the things you said tonight were things that I had learned at school or subsequently, I hadn't seen them all knitted together in the way that you've done. So we thank you for that. In Faculty Council seeks in Scotland to build what we're describing as a triangle between the profession on one corner, academia on another, and business and commerce as the third corner in that triangle, hopefully with the blessing of the Scottish Government around it. And we are working hard to that. There's much more we can do. And we recognise that some of what went wrong in the credit crunch was precisely the silo point that you described, that individuals in banks knew a huge amount about overdrafts, other individuals in banks knew a whole load about credit cards, other knew, and so on round. And yet nobody was taking that overview that saw all the different risks in some kind of context and saw the common thread of risk, liquidity and credit that ran through all of them. So nobody was on the bridge, everybody was down in the engine room. And we hope that the actuarial profession, in part because of our new qualification, in part because of the efforts we're doing to develop people's skills, might play a part on that bridge and make the financial waters a bit safer in the future. Whether or not we succeed in that quest will be down to us, but to you, Sir Michael, we are very grateful for the insight and the inspiration to allow us to do it. And I would like, firstly, the audience to show their grateful thanks to you for your inspiring talk tonight. And secondly, for you to accept this paperweight with the faculty crest on it as a small token of our appreciation for what you've done tonight. Thank you. Pleasure. And lastly, to Lady Lily, who has once again given up her husband for the evening for the greater good of science and humanity, a small token of our gratitude for you being here tonight and releasing your husband yet again. We have an activity in Scotland goes on apace, and in the course of the next month, the Life Convention will be taking place later this week in Edinburgh. There's our Changing Future Forum on the 3rd of December, the Momentum Convention, which used to be called the Younger Members Convention before that became politically incorrect, takes place in Glasgow at the beginning of December, and our next sessional meeting will be on the 18th of January, and the title will, it'll be a paper by Nick Silver, and the title will be Resource and Environmental Interest Groups Paper on the Risk of Ruin, a Framework for Reviewing Greenhouse Gas Stabilization, something that is absolutely to the moment today and demonstrates the profession's ability to reach beyond its traditional financial areas of expertise. Thank you all for coming tonight and for participating. I invite you now all to join us for a drink outside. Thank you.